Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags with a brisk 30 minutes on the latest in South African and global news. We are live and then up as a podcast. I'll bring you insightful interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, all in a concise, informative update. It's Wednesday, March the 27th. Coming up on the program, the Speaker of the House crisis intensifies. We'll hear about the motion of no confidence and a view from the ruling party. What next as tertiary education institutions are deregistered? And will Israel follow a UN Gaza Strip ceasefire directive? The Democratic Alliance's request for a motion of no confidence against the parliamentary speaker who's accused of corruption has been approved by the acting speaker. Let's get a view on that now from the Democratic Alliance's parliamentary chief whip, Siviwe Kharube. Good afternoon to you and welcome. Explain to us why you have brought this motion.
Good afternoon, Jeremy, and good afternoon to your listeners. It was very, very important for us to bring a motion of no confidence against the speaker. Because, of course, she faces some grave allegations against her of corruption and money laundering. And our view is that the person that leads the legislative arm of state should be somebody who is beyond reproach, somebody who will not erode the public trust of the institution. And it is important that we now, because we have called for her resignation, but she has refused to step down, and therefore now we have been left with no choice but to table a motion of no confidence against her.
Is the fact that she's gone on special leave not enough?
Absolutely not, Jeremy, and I think this is important for accountability. Firstly, special leave is not accounted for in the rules of the National Assembly. Special leave is meant to be something that is accounted for or approved by a full sitting of the House. The speaker decided to take a unilateral decision to take special leave, which is not something that we're aware of or on the basis of what rules. And secondly, in South Africa, we need to start instilling a culture of accountability where people are not just stepping down or stepping aside or taking special leave, that when people are found to be wanting in the roles that they occupy, then they need to either resign or then be forced to resign through, for instance, a removal, which is provided for in the Constitution and in the rules of the National Assembly. So we don't think it's enough at all, because also in addition to that, which is an important point, Jeremy, the Speaker continues to use Parliament to communicate about her legal battles through the parliamentary channels. We don't know who's footing her legal bills, but it's very, very important that we immediately start to insulate the institution from her legal troubles.
Is it your party's contention that she is then receiving special treatment?
We definitely think that the ANC is notorious for this kind of these kind of tactics, Jeremy, where politicians and those who are politically aligned are given a special treatment in many ways. Because the speaker, I mean, had her house raided about a week or two ago by the NPA. She claims on the one side that she's wanting her day in court, but on the other side, essentially she's interdicting the NPA. These are classic Zuma tactics, which we have seen before. And of course, I mean, the ANC is not immune to this kind of behavior. And so it's going to be very interesting now that we are pushing for this motion to be voted on in the next coming days, Jeremy, to see, is the ANC going to do what they've always done, which is to shield their own from accountability, or are they going to actually do the right thing and vote with the motion? Because, well, I mean, they've clearly been unable to get the speaker to resign.
Well, I think you know what the answer to that is. So my question to you is, how much opposition support do you have in the House?
Look, I mean, we have written to all opposition parties in Parliament, including the ANC. I know that collectively we have 170 members in the opposition bloc. I know that the EFF has recently communicated that they will be in support of such a motion. And I believe that we wouldn't struggle to get the opposition parties on our side. But the big question then, of course, becomes what will the ANC do? And if of course, they don't support the motion, then, you know, it is up to the ANC to then explain to the people of South Africa why it is that they continuously continue to shield people from accountability.
And the Speaker's contention that she is the victim of an apartheid-style witch hunt?
I think that is, it's very much for me, it's very reminiscent of the Zuma era years where, you know, when somebody continues to say that they want their day in court, they are disputing the charges or the allegations leveled against them. But at the same time, they continue to evade that kind of accountability. I think it's absolutely bizarre. And I think that the NPA, when they were in court, were able to state quite categorically that, I mean, why, you know, the speaker's essentially wanting special treatment here. And they, you know, I believe adequately fought against that. And so we wait to see until our next Monday to hear what the court case is. But we still believe that Parliament must proceed with its own processes that holds its own accountable.
To the Speaker's point, though, and I obviously hold no brief for her, but the raid yielded nothing. And it was an early morning raid designed to intimidate.
I don't think so. I mean, the speaker firstly also wants to be given notice before an arrest is made. I mean, Jeremy, I'm not au fait with how the criminal justice system works, but from my understanding is that, you know, people, when you are under investigation, and which I believe she must have known that she was under investigation, they had no obligation to give you a heads up before they come and raid your home. And I don't think it's intimidation. The reality here is that the speaker is facing some serious, serious allegations. And so if I was her, and if I really did believe that I somehow was innocent, then I would make sure that I avail myself for the scrutiny and that I avail myself for whatever court case there is so that I may be able to disprove whatever allegations. But she's not behaving like somebody who seeks to disprove the allegations leveled against her.
All right. Thank you very much indeed. I want to stay with the story now. And constitutional academic Professor Pierre Dufosse writing that the speaker's position has become untenable. She is, however, unlikely to resign soon, not least because she continues to enjoy political support from the ANC, as we have just been discussing. Let's get an ANC perspective now from the party. Mangeni Bengu Motsiri, thank you and welcome. You have no choice but to support her. Will you concede that this is damaging to both your party and also to Parliament?
Well, correction, we do have a choice to say to the Speaker, like any other member of the ANC that is found to be in some senses in conflict with the law. We do have an option of saying you present yourself to the Integrity Commission of the ANC, allow the internal democratic process of the ANC to kick in, and of course, given the sensitivity of her position in Parliament, we are duty-bound to do so for the sake of the people of South Africa and for the sake of the integrity of the ANC. Whatever people may think about our integrity and ethics management processes, but we do have a robust integrity management system that has kicked in quite strongly in the past year under the leadership of Reverend Frank Chikane. So as I understand it, she is appearing before the Integrity Commission. I'm not certain that it's whether today or tomorrow, because we are here in Durban at the High Court for our trademark challenge against the Zuma Party. So I just wanted to clarify that it's not a matter of supporting someone willy-nilly. It has to be measured and carefully considered decision when we do make such a decision.
I understand the perspective, but would it not be easier if she were simply to resign at this point, given the damage or the potential damage that could be caused?
Well, there's a fine line, Jeremy, as you would know, between trial by public opinion, or let me say in this instance also sections of the media. And I never believe that we should think that the media is homogeneous. there's a fine line between that and somebody being allowed to exercise their rights in law. So we are watching that space very, very closely as the ANC. But as I said, the Integrity Commission has already asked her to appear before it on an urgent basis.
Do you agree with the speaker's sentiments that this entire issue is what she has termed an apartheid-style witch hunt?
I can't comment on that because I'm not privy to what she's been subjected to. All that I can restate is the official position of the ANC, that all are equal before the law.
How is your party going to vote then in the motion of no confidence that's going to be held?
Well, I think that question, we do have what we call the 10th province in the ANC called a parliamentary caucus, because they've been given the powers to communicate on behalf of the ANC on matters that are parliamentary. And I suspect that that question is best addressed with the chief whip, who is a member of the National Working Committee of the ANC, Pemi Majodina, and a member of the National Executive Committee. But I would say that the position of the ANC is all are equal before the law, and the rule of law is sacrosanct.
Do you or does your party believe this motion is necessary?
Well, I believe that those parties that have brought the motion forward have a right to do so. I don't think that as the ANC, we should stand in the way of any of that using our, you know, majoritarian principle. But I believe that it is important for these matters to be ventilated in Parliament. I mean, this is we're talking about a presiding officer, the foremost presiding officer of Parliament. So I don't think that the parties have got to be denied that role. That can then be ventilated in the debate and the debate on the motion.
Is it fair to say, though, that your party still has confidence in her?
To the extent that she has not had clear charges preferred against her, we have no reason not to that extent. But, as I say, that the conduct of the state on this matter also has just not been beyond, so above reproach. You would agree with that, hopefully, in terms of just how they would announce an imminent arrest, and the arrest doesn't happen, and they raid her house. They don't find what they're looking for. So there's, to a large extent, though, a trial by the media. That is where I would say, on behalf of the ANC, that it is not fair on anyone, regardless of their position or rank in society.
You say she's facing a trial by the media, but surely the media has just been reporting on the turn of events.
Yes. But I'm just saying that if you were to be found to have committed some malfeasance of any kind at MoneyWeb, you need to be given charges, you need to be arrested or not arrested, or you need to be given options that are available to you through the rule of law. So we expect that any member of society, regardless of whether they're ANC or whether they're high ranking, need to be treated the same way.
But I, to extend your metaphor, I would have no problem if the media were to be reporting on what transpired at MoneyWeb, should this be happening to me. That's within the purview of the media, surely.
No, definitely. The media certainly has to communicate to society and has got to formulate the narrative in the way that they decide to do so. We don't have a problem with that. I personally don't have a problem with that. I mean, the ANC fought for media diversity in South Africa, for that matter. That's why today we have the kind of media freedoms that we enjoy. So we don't have a challenge with that at all. Certainly I can speak for myself, having been exposed to the media at a young age. The point I'm raising, though, is the fact that the issue of her being arrested or imminent arrest was reported in the media before the NPA executed or sought to execute, even raid at home. So there are just many things that are not rhyming with, say, us as the ANC. But we will never defend, as I say, we will never defend anyone that is in conflict with law, because we should be setting an example ourselves as the ANC and sending a positive and a correct message to society that we are an organization that is self-cleansing and renewing itself. And one of those is really enforcing ethics and integrity management in the organization.
Just finally, why is this trademark case so important to your party?
Well, because it belongs to our forebears. It belongs to our forebears. It belongs to the ANC. The MK Umkhonto weSizwe, as a War Veterans Association, reported to the ANC, was established by the ANC under President Oliver Reginald Tambo. Surely, if we can't defend his name and his work and that of all those that succeeded him, Nelson Mandela and many others, we would be forsaking our liberation heritage and our legacy. So this is not just us having money to run around in courts. We're busy in our elections campaign, but there's no way we can allow the name Umkhonto weSizwe to be stolen by one individual who believes that he's bigger than the ANC itself and is bigger than society. Jacob Zuma, if he wants to register a party, he should have registered the party in his name, Jacob Zuma Party. It's as simple as that. It's not even a no-brainer. It's actually a no-brainer.
Thank you very much for joining me.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
All right, let's move away from politics now to education. The fate of hundreds of thousands of students registered with Damlin, City Varsity and Lyceum College hangs in the balance today after the institution's registrations were cancelled by the Department of Higher Education. I'm in conversation now with Veli Mbele, who speaks for the department. Veli, welcome to remind us what this means both for the institutions and for students.
Thank you so much for the opportunity and afternoon to your listeners. So this follows a decision that was done, taken by the department through the registrar, right? The registrar in this case is the director general in terms of the regulations. The registrar, who's the director general, published the cancellation of the four institutions under EDUCO, you've mentioned City Varsity, Damalan, IKESA, and Lyceum. Which implies the following, right, that they will now be required to stop operating as a registered institution. And amongst others, the implications are the following, that they would have to have formally informed the students. That's what the regulations require them to do. Where there are students who have got monies that are due to them, they have to reimburse those students. But the other thing that they are also required to do in terms of the regulations is to make sure that they assist in those students getting alternative academic institutions, be they public or private, for them to complete their courses. That's in the regulations. And when they receive their registration or accreditation as a private higher education institution, that is part of the obligations they agree to.
Right? And to the best of your knowledge, is that or has that happened?
To the best of our knowledge, that has not happened. And one of them being, I mean, the most basic, many of the queries we've gotten from students suggest that they have not even been given the decency of being formally informed. Because just this morning, I was dealing with at least three new queries from students who heard me talk on radio yesterday, and they have informed me about their frustration with regards to the poor communication of EDUCO. So we have evidence to suggest that they have not even had the decency to formally inform the students. And we are trying to help on our end as the department.
So what is your next step then in terms of that process?
So next step is the notice, or rather the decision to cancel, requires the EDUCO group to make an appeal to the department, right? The decision can be appealed. So they are required to make an appeal, which appeal will then determine whether the department will uphold or review the decision. And just by way of background, this was communicated to them in July last year, formally through the Gazette. And since July, they've been asking for extensions. The first extension was for September 2023. We granted that. Then they asked for an extension until February this year. We also granted that. They have now asked for a third extension for October 2024. And the extensions relate to them promising to address the issues we had raised with them. And unfortunately, we have not seen any serious attempt on their part to address the issues for which we have granted them an extension. And this is why it has come to this, because we had to protect the students from an institution or set of institutions that are actually operating in a manner that's not consistent with the regulations. And we could not endorse this.
And if they're not doing that, what about students who have qualifications already from those institutions? Would they still be recognized? Do they still have value?
Yes, remember, and we made it clear in the media briefing yesterday, there's no pronouncement that the department has made in its correspondence and in the media briefing as it relates to the validity of the academic qualifications that students are acquired through this institution. So at this stage, we have not, the academic qualifications are not in question. And this is why we have made the offer to help assist in finding them alternative placement, right? So there shouldn't be panic as it relates to the academic qualifications, because we have not made that pronouncement or determination as the department. For now, we are dealing with mainly the compliance issues relating to their financials and other issues that relate to their operating standards.
Approximately how many students do you think are involved?
The number that we have, which was initially misrepresented, right? The number that we have is 13,096.
And the minister saying yesterday, warning these institutions not to use PR spin, what was he saying?
Essentially, what the minister sought to communicate by that was that it will not be useful to want to deal with this matter by wanting to engage in a public spat, right, amongst others, or to try and cast doubt insofar as the decision of the department is concerned. So the minister was essentially saying there's an opportunity for the leadership of EDUCO to engage the department, and the best way to engage the department is by using the existing formal channels, right? Because any other form of engagement is not going to be helpful. We need the leadership of EDUCO, wherever they are, to come to the table and talk to the department so that we find a solution. That's really our interest as the department. And this is not meant to embarrass them or to humiliate anybody. We were just doing what we are obliged to do in terms of the law. But there is still an opportunity to talk to them, or for them to talk to us as the department.
You've mentioned the four institutions. Would the department be probing other institutions as well as these?
So the department generally, either based on public information or based on our own knowledge, we generally conduct investigations, right? So it's not an extraordinary thing. We generally conduct investigations. Remember, we also have a standing campaign as a department that relates to exposing bogus colleges. So it is always something that we are monitoring throughout the year. So it wouldn't be extraordinary.
But the focus right now is the students themselves. That's where the sympathy lies and where the concern should be.
Absolutely. And I can tell you now, just before we actually took this interview, I was just helping two students through our unit that deals with private higher education. They sent queries to me directly. I was just dealing with those. And that is the focus, quite correctly, at least from our part. And hopefully, hopefully we will get the leadership of EDUCO to come to us so that they can also help in the effort. I am helping, in my capacity as an official, and so do the rest of the team that is working with us to give the students the answers that we can give them, the advice, and to direct them both in terms of their studies and the reimbursement.
All right, Velian Bele, thank you very much indeed from the Department of Higher Education.
MoneyWeb at midday. For all your up-to-date stories.
Overnight, South Africa welcoming the adoption by the UN Security Council of a resolution demanding an immediate ceasefire in the Gaza Strip after the United States withheld its veto to enable Resolution 2728 to pass. Professor Sipa Mandla-Zondi is an international relations commentator attached to the University of Johannesburg and joins me now on the program. And Professor, the doubts, I imagine, would be intensifying about whether Israel is in fact going to implement this decision.
Yes, it is. It's a major milestone to have got this resolution specifically calling for a permanent ceasefire and actually asking Israel to stop its military operation in a way and therefore not go into Rafah. And it is a huge development that the United States did not block this. But as you say, The next hurdle would be whether the UN has the ability to enforce this and therefore cause Israel to indeed ceasefire. Mm. My own sense is that Israel knows that there's very little price to pay for ignoring this, and therefore it just simply closes its eyes and insists that it's wronged, and insists that it's just dealing with an existential threat, and that it is in its pivotal national interest for it to continue and then take the fall from that. I think it has got to a point where it knows that it cannot fall any deeper than it has. It's been isolated for a long period of time. It may just be got to a point where it just doesn't care, especially under Netanyahu.
And that, of course, Professor, dilutes the authority, the gravitas, surely, of the Security Council itself.
It does. It demonstrates some of the fault lines in our UN-based international system. It's a fault line that it was born with in 1945. The fact that it hardly has the ability to enforce its decision unless if those decisions are actively and enthusiastically sponsored by big powers who then on behalf of the UN enforce it. If you look at a UN resolution on Libya to a resolution 2011, it was actually enforced by the UK, US and France on behalf of the UN Security Council, but they chose to do that. But I don't see anyone wanting to put in their military to try and force Israel to abide this. So while there's a lot of enthusiasm, but there isn't courage to the point that anyone want to put their troops on the ground in order to enforce this resolution.
Are you detecting a change in tone or approach as far as the United States is concerned? And I'm looking at a statement from the Israel Prime Minister's office, which has slammed the U.S. abstention from this vote as, and I quote, a retreat from the consistent U.S. position since the start of the war that it would harm Israel's war effort as well as its attempts to free the remaining hostages. So, is the United States recalibrating its position, do you think?
I think it is navigating a tightrope. I mean, this has gone on and it has been damaging. It has been very divisive in terms of the domestic audience in the United States. It has sharpened its internal contradictions within the United States. And there are elections coming, very critical elections. So they have to gain some ground. They need to win some votes, especially in the northeastern part of the United States and some part of the southwestern part of the United States and other areas. They need to track that balance of being seen to be balanced a little bit without actually going all the way to enforce any of these decisions. But at least give something to those who are critical of the United States just allowing Israel to do as it wish. And I think 30,000 dead, including women and children, hit some badly in the United States. So they have to do that balance. It's really about the domestic rather than the international environment.
And as far as South Africa is concerned, our foreign minister is in the United States too. And again, I quote, affirm the very positive relationship between South Africa and the United States and to advocate for the continued participation of South Africa in AGOA, the African Growth and Opportunity Act. As far as South Africa is concerned, that visit is very important because we have been, relations between Pretoria and Washington have been tricky, I guess, to say the least.
Yes, they've always been tricky and they have now been strained. And they've been strained to the point where there is a build-up of a momentum towards a further decline, maybe to dangerous levels. Dangerous levels in this case mean a possibility of freezing certain elements of the relationship, freezing South Africa's participation in AGOA, perhaps even get to a point where there might be sanctions against this or that element of the South African state. So there's an attempt to prevent that further slide so that you keep the relationship fragile as it has been for the past 30 years, but stable. You know, when you say fragile but stable, we know it. You know that phrase in the South African space. You need to keep it and you will never overcome its fragility, but you need to make sure that in its fragility, it is stable enough that you prevent a slide further to the negative. And that is what is the big one. With that U.S. Congress bill that has called the U.S. administration to conduct a review of South Africa's relations with the United States. A review is to check whether this is still in line with U.S. interest and whether this is no longer is not turning into hostile, which is really dangerous territory. And I think it's one of the things that has prompted the minister to go on this roadshow to try and persuade the U.S. constituencies. I saw that she's chosen very carefully the constituencies that she's engaging with, but I didn't see much engagement with the Congress, which is the one that is on the front line right now in terms of the review of the relationship.
Professor Sipa Mandla-Zondi from the University of Johannesburg, thank you very much indeed. And let me just remind you about our online poll yesterday. I asked you if you support the whole Buy Local initiative. The options were yes, no, and I worry over quality and price. And interesting to see that we have a resounding majority of our respondents saying they support local business. Today, and related to two interviews we did on the program, the fate of the Speaker of the House. Should she resign? Special leave is enough, or I have confidence in the investigation. If you have a view, please go to MoneyWeb on Twitter X or also on our LinkedIn page. MoneyWeb at midday. We are live at noon weekdays. We are then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.